Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block. Yes, people, it's the Writer's Block. It's a Sunday. It's 10 p.m. here in lovely Skopje, Macedonia. It's been pouring rain outside all day, but I'm all refreshed and ready for you. I'm here with Muhammad Izadi, sometimes known as Muhammad Aryan, who's a longtime commentator on Countercurrents, and I've seen him around in the chats on Odyssey, on DLive, here in the Writer's Block, and during Countercurrents Radio on Saturdays. Muhammad, how are you doing tonight?
I am fine. How about you, Mr. Gilby?
I'm doing fine. I'm doing well. I'm actually in good spirits and good health for a change. It's always something or other, but I guess it's to be expected with age. It's just one of those things, I guess. And tonight we are here to discuss, we are going to discuss some of Muhammad can contribute to the white nationalist discourse, but first, we gotta take care of some administrative matters on the Writer's Block. Of course, I expect a lot of audience questions tonight. I expect the subject we are going to discuss to arouse a lot of interest. So, you want to get ahead of the game. You want to send your questions, comments, and donations via Entropy. That's how you can donate to Countercurrents, since we do have a fundraiser going on. We are raising funds. We're trying to keep this operation going because apparently it consumes a lot of money. And believe you me, when I saw those accounts, I nearly had a heart attack. We're going to need your everything if we're going to keep our heads above water for another year. So you can donate to us through our Entropy link, which our heroic moderators will, of course, put in the chat. And that's how you can also ask us questions, give us your comments. And you can also donate through Cash App, which takes a smaller percentage, which, if you really got nothing to say, but would like to give us some funds out of the goodness of your hearts, you can also use that. And we also have, I forget which crypto service we're using. I think it's MoonPay. But you can also donate crypto to us. We have the various crypto addresses over on Countercurrents. And you can also use your credit card to convert to crypto through MoonPay. Apparently it is MoonPay. And those are the direct ways in which you can support Countercurrents. And for the duration of the stream, you can send us donations on DLive and Odyssey. You can send us your lemons, your ice creams, your ninjets, ninja genies, and those ever elusive diamonds over on DLive and on Odyssey. We accept both library tokens, which are Odyssey's very own cryptocurrency, apparently, and cash money, which you can also donate through Odyssey, and you can also pose us questions by using the Odyssey Super Chat. So that's all the ways you can directly donate through Countercurrents, and of course, you can always support us by purchasing the fine product of our sponsor, Alaska Chaga. Alaska Chaga is a delicious NFT, a nice fungal tea, a wonderful beverage. I hear from a certain lovely lady in a floral print dress that today is International Tea Day. And, I'm going to have a tea. I'm going to have Alaska Chaga. If I could live stream that smell. It's got antioxidants, or so I've been told. And it's also very delicious. And it's refreshing, you know, because I got to speak for 2 hours straight. I got to get something to hydrate my mouth. But I think that's enough of all of the crass financial concerns. We do have a guest here. And Muhammad Aryan, you've been quite consistent in your comments for as long as I have followed you, that white people would benefit from the Islamic faith. I would like to give you the opportunity right now to make your case. Why should white identitarian nationalists, so people in our political milieu, consider Islam as a possible alternative?
Okay. So allow me to first introduce myself to the audience. My full name is Muhammad A. Izadi. I am purposefully withholding my given name, which comes in the middle. The custom of naming is a bit different in this part of the world. I also do not want to show my face. I would like to keep this much anonymity. Izzat was my grandfather's given name. It is an Avestan word, which means one who is worthy of reverence. Avestan was an old Iranian language in which Zoroastrian scriptures were written down. The E vowel sound at the end signifies possession. It means of Izzat. I'm a Muslim by faith. I belong to the 12er Shia school. I live in Karachi, which is the southern port city of Pakistan on the western side of the mighty river Indus. What do I do for a living? I think let's just say a feature of my profession includes working in the archives, old newspapers, magazines, books. My paternal forefathers left the northeastern Iranian city of Nishapur in the final quarter of the 18th century. They moved towards northern India and settled between the rivers Yamuna and Ganges, the region which lies at the feet of the Shivalik Hills, which literally means tresses of Lord Shiva. They had already embraced Islam while they were still in Iran. As far as my maternal side is concerned, I can guess on the basis of the information that I have been able to gather that they too moved eastwards from West Asia sometime during the Mughal rule. They settled in Lucknow, which is presently the provincial capital of the northern Indian state of Uttar Pradesh. Then in 1947, after the creation of Pakistan, my ancestors decided to make a westward journey. They crossed Indus and made Karachi their home. My mother tongue is Urdu, which is a blend of Persian and Sanskrit. Phonetically, it is one of the richest languages in the world. I have been commenting on Countercurrents under the name Muhammad Aryan for the last 5 years. I think I made my first comment in the late 2016 or early 2017. In 2016, I discovered Countercurrents through the late Jonathan Bowden. I came across his lectures on YouTube when YouTube was still brimming with quality dissident material. It was as if I had stumbled on some valuable treasure regarding Occidental studies. Along with the late Mr. Bowden, I had begun reading such luminaries of the right as Anthony Ludovici, Carrie Bolton, Alain de Benoist, René Guénon, Julius Evola, Colin Clary, Kevin MacDonald, Ricardo Duchesne, Jared Taylor, etc. And simultaneously, I had also started to closely follow the content that was being created by Messrs. Frodi Midgiord, Morgoth, The Z-Man, Voxday, Devon Stack of Black Pearl, The Nation's Jazz Hands, The Fash The Nation's Jazz Hand McFeels, Jean-François Garipi, Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson, Svan Longshanks of Radio Aryan, now Radio Albion, I think, Mark Enoch of The Right Stuff and others. And naturally, revisionists such as David Irving, Ernst Zundel, Robert Frisson, Gamma Rudel, Fred Leuchter, etc., too naturally came into my focus during this time. I mean, I list them all not as some show-off. I intend to let it be known that I follow this domain not as some hobby or a pastime. It is a serious endeavor. I seriously follow this domain. Now, and naturally, one can ask, why do I do this? You see, Mr. Jilvi, our region has had a long history with the Occident. After the settlement of the Aryan folk in this part of the world, the Indus Valley civilization and all, the first major contact with the Occident was Alexander of Macedon's eastward movement, the Battle of Hedaspes, which was fought incidentally on the banks of River Jhelum, probably south of the present city of Jhelum in Upper Punjab. After his demise, several satrapies of the erstwhile Macedonian Empire sprang up. These Indo-Greek kingdoms remained for the next 3 centuries. And then almost 16 centuries later, this subcontinent once again became part of an empire whose center of gravity was in the Occident. I'm talking about, naturally, of the British Raj. The French, the Dutch, Portuguese, and even the Danes also left significant traces. Therefore, it should not be surprising if someone from this region takes serious interest in Occidental affairs. After all, there exists a sort of historical intimacy between these two regions. Moreover, belonging to one linguistic family that stretches from the Atlantic to the Bay of Bengal should also make this endeavor, I think, not too strange or suspicious an affair. So this is the introduction I wanted to give. And I think now, should I proceed with my argument?
That is a very thorough introduction, and I thank you for that. It's interesting that we can all we swim in the same intellectual waters. It's a source of continual amazement to me that even though we may be separated by geography and by racial descent and by all of the differences between us, we do have a culture in common, being distance from the mainstream right in the West. I'm of course we can come back to this. I'm always interested for perspectives of people who are on the outside looking in but have a familiarity with the culture and the grammar of the discourse. And in my ways, my own in many ways, my own work is really that, looking from the outside at the West, because I'm not exactly fully Western. I am part of Eastern Europe, the Balkans. We are, for the same reason you have such an interest in the Occident, I have an interest in the Eastern empires, in Persia, in the Ottoman Empire, in all of the lands of the Byzantine Empire, because we were at one point. I don't think was the Sindh were the Sindh and the Balkans part of the same state, but Persia was definitely at one point occupied by the Ottoman Turks at the same time as the Balkans. So, I get a chance to indulge my intellectual caprices on this show, and I wanted to hear your argumentation. I wanted to hear you make the case for Islam to a white nationalist and white identitarian audience, because I think there is a case to be made. Do continue.
Okay. Before going into the main argumentation, I just as you were talking, I remember I just came a thing to my mind. I saw a news clip recently. It was from northern Punjab and northwestern Punjab, and there are tribes in northwestern Punjab who still quite proudly pronounced that our forefathers came with Alexander and we are Macedonians. Even in fact, I have a news clip. I will send it to you.
Are they the Hunza tribe?
No. The Hunza tribe is located a bit north of Punjab, in the Kashmir Valley, in the west of the Kashmir Valley. This tribe is very much Punjabi and Western Punjabi in the Kalabagh region, and they very proudly still claim that they are Macedonians, and then they like this place and they settle there and so on. Let me make or state the parameters within which I would make my argument. One, this is not an academic or expert scholarly take on Islam. I speak as a Muslim, not as a professional authority on Islam. All over the world, universities contain hundreds of scholars of Islam, but that does not necessarily imply that they are also Muslim by faith and follow the commands in their own lives. To quote Morpheus from The Matrix, knowing the path is different from walking the path. Secondly, this should not be seen as East patronizing the West with its quote-unquote wisdom. Islam is not something North, South, East, or West. If Indo-Aryans, Iranians, Tajiks, Baloch, Punjabis, Afghans, etc. start living our lives against the fitra, the primordial state crudely referred to as, I think, the default settings of humans on which Allah Almighty has created the human beings, then eventually they too will ethnically as well as spiritually destroy themselves. There are no chosen ethnicities in Islam. all must remain on their guard against falsehood. It is the man who needs to firmly clasp the handhold of Haq, the ultimate reality. Haq is the Arabic term we use for the ultimate reality. It is one of the attributes of Allah Almighty, and not the other way around. It is man's needs and not the other way around. Lastly, my station also needs to be mentioned. I am not speaking as a member of a diaspora community whose family immigrated to the West to amass wealth, and now I am dabbling in some interfaith, market-oriented globalist racket while enjoying the fruits of foreign citizenship. My feet are firmly on my soil, which contains the bones of my ancestors and on which we have been for thousands of years. So, what is Islam? To answer the question, we should first state what it is not. Islam is not an Arab religion. Islam is not a tool of Arab imperialism. Islam is not a child of Judaism. It is not a heresy of Christianity. And it is not an Abrahamic religion. It is not Mohammedanism. And certainly, it is not Hajjism, a thesis proposed by the likes of the late Patricia Crone in the late 1970s. Islam means submission to the ultimate reality. It is not this or that ism. The word Islam does not point to any person, tribe, or a terrestrial location, which is only unique to Islam. A Muslim does not worship Arabs or an Arabian tribe or some other corporeal being. The Orientalists, although did some valuable work, failed to escape the gravitational pull of their native conceptual frameworks. Hence, when they came across Islam, they tried to comprehend it through terms like religion, clergy, scripture, rituals. They, in their ignorance, saw Islam as some regional cult. They invented vacuous terms like Mohammedanism or Mohammedans to refer Islam and Muslims. Because there is Christianity and Christians, Judaism and Jews, Hinduism and Hindus, Buddhism and Buddhists, paganism and pagans, therefore it somehow logically also follows that there will be Mohammedanism and Mohammedans. It was a serious error, I think, that only undermined their own research. Islam will have to be understood according to its own terms and etiquettes. I learned about the Anglophone strain of white nationalism from sources like Countercurrents, American Renaissance, Jonathan Bowden, etc., and not through SPLC, ADL, or other ridiculous outlets like the New York Times or CNN. So Islam is the culmination of metaphysics. It is the zenith. It validates all the components of this chain, whether they appeared on north, south, east, or west. Prophets were sent to every people. However, they were specific to their own realms, yet part of a singular chain. They were all Muslim. And one more thing, there are no Jewish or Christian prophets in Islam. All the prophets in our tradition, whether it be Prophet Ibrahim, Moses, Isa, we call him Isa, it's Jesus, Enoch, Elijah, or all the great prophets, they are referred to as Muslims. They are not Jews, they are not Christians. And secondly, Islam is a meta-historical benchmark. It is a vertical paradigm to observe and measure the movement of history. Man's rationality has its limitations. It cannot eject itself from the flow of history on its own. It needs assistance. And that assistance is Wahi, which is contained in the Quran. Now, to answer your question briefly, why I propose or I advocate Islam for the white race. Islam offers white race or any other ethnicity two things. A vocabulary to understand man, his self, and his relationship with the ultimate reality. And second, and this is crucial, a permanent state of social mobilization. The word Quran means recitation. Why was it revealed in Arabic? As a Muslim, only Allah Almighty knows the definitive reasoning. On the basis of our finite understanding, I think we can deduce that, firstly, it is the lexical preciseness. Arabic vocabulary is breathtakingly profound. Secondly, ancient Arabia had a very strong emphasis on oral communication. There is a certain mystique associated with chants and hymns. some portals of reality and reality with a capital R can only be unlocked through intonation. Quran 2 stresses on intonation. And there is a slight misconception in Western circles that they see this written Arabic script in paper or in a form of a book, and they refer to that book as Quran. It is actually the Mushaf. What we read and what we recite from our tongue, it is Quran. And the Mushaf is for those who have not yet memorized it or are in the process of memorizing, because every Muslim is expected to memorize a part of the scripture, to recite it in the daily five prayers. Now, Islam is not alien to the white race. There have been notable converts in the last 100 years. Britishers like William Pickthall, Guy Eaton, Martin Lings, Timothy Winter, then René Guénon of France, Freitschof Schön from Switzerland, Michel Velson from Romania, and a not too prominent American white convert, the late Nuruddin Durki. He is a Sufi of Shazilia order. It is a Sufi order in Egypt. There is an interesting website which goes by the name of islamforeuropeans.com. There is also a YouTube channel of the same moniker. It is run by a Canadian white convert whose name is Robert. He often invites white converts to his channel. Interestingly, he thinks that white converts to Islam should have their own white sub-communities. He made an appearance on Dr. Edward Dutton's BitTube channel in February this year. So
that's very interesting.
Yes. So why Islam? Because it is only Islam that engenders what I refer to a moment back. Now I'm going to define that term of the permanent state. What do I mean by a permanent state of social mobilization? Because nowadays the dissident sphere has been witnessing a kind of a skirmish between populists and elitists. We have Mr. Nima Pervini's book recently, The Populist Delusion. And so what do I mean by that? In the communitarian space, Islam regulates my relationship with my blood relatives, father, mother, brothers, sisters, grandfather, grandmother, both paternal and maternal. And next comes my relationship with my spouses, offspring. And last of all, my relationship with the wider social order that surrounds me. Friends, relatives, neighbors, co-workers, companions in a journey known as Ibn Sabil in Arabic. A very unique term. Those people who accompany you in your journeys, who are complete strangers but sit by your side in a bus or in a taxi or in a train. And Islam has no place whatsoever for monasticism or hermeticism. My individualism should be healthily actualizing within my community that contains my blood relatives and co-ethnics. Respect for elders and kindness for youngsters are mandatory regardless of their faith. Even if one is Muslim and his parents are not, he or she is still commanded to treat them gently. Now here I would like to mention the sheer obscenity of old care nursing homes that is not only prevalent in the West, but they are now propping up in our part of the world also, where the elderly folk spend their last years. It is like a human scrapyard where the industrial society throws the obsolete and the outdated. Sadly, these establishments have also propped up in our parts of the world. This is something personal. I would like to share it. It was the greatest honor of my life to perform the ritual washing and shrouding of my father and uncles when they passed away. I stood in their graves and placed them with my own hands. And every atom of my being thanks Allah Almighty for that. Not everyone get these chances in their lives. And this is what I call a permanent state of social mobilization. This is the this is the metapolitical nourishment that white nationalists need. I mean, if white societies are bound to turn into the Lebanon of 70s and 80s, then I think whites will need their Hezbollah. They are like 12ers and they will need their Hezbollah to mobilize themselves. The social mobilization component is absolutely crucial because the political plank will be placed on that foundation. There is too much bureaucratization in West because, the value that prevails in the West is the values of the market. You know, much of the movements which sincerely organize themselves while not challenging the prevalent axiological order, the value system, the totalitarian bureaucratic value system of the West. Without challenging that system, and that system can only be countered and checked when there is organic social relationships, when the organic nature of our social relationships is intact. I mean,
I think I understand what you mean, Muhammad.
Yes.
It's, I agree with you that we will need a very strong community, which is organically linked to each other. And as you put it, socially mobilized to take on our enemies. That part I agree with. The first thing you said why white people would benefit from the Islamic faith is because it holds the key to grasping the great truth, right? As you would say, I was not going to respond to that because all religions have this claim, and for my part, being an Orthodox Christian, Orthodox Christianity has served me quite well in this regard. It has certainly given me a grammar for understanding the problems of man. But the second part, that's very interesting to me. When you were speaking about having the privilege to wash your father's body, I'm actually familiar with this Muslim ritual because we do have a lot of Muslims here in Macedonia.
Yes.
And yeah. And I was reminded really of the privilege of when my grandfather died, I was given the task of in the funeral procession carrying the cross bearing his name all the way from the chapel to the graveyard. And this is what it reminded me of. And now I'm thinking that all of these commandments, which all of this social structure which Islam provides for you and your people, well, Christianity provides for me and my people, and it has for a very long time. And of course, there are people in this chat listening and listening to the replay who are of European native faith, what we call pagans, who gain both the explanatory, get a grasp on the grammar of the world or something approaching it, you know, from their own native faith, and also get the social fulfillment and social mobilization, as you put it, from their faith. So I was really interested in the social mobilization part because it seemed to me from your argumentation that Islam might provide better and maybe easier social mobilization than other faiths. But from your own words, it would seem that the Western fetishism of markets and bureaucracy is penetrating into the Islamic world as well. Maybe this is a good side alley, a good tangent to go on. How much has the rot of Western culture, and I'm really not ashamed to admit that it is quite rotten over here, how much has it penetrated the Muslim world? Or if you're not aware about the broader Muslim world, maybe just about Pakistan and maybe Muslim India.
I mean, I would not hide anything from you. I would say it quite plainly and disclose it honestly. Every single sin that you see in the West is more or less present in our society also. Not in that magnitude as we see in the West, but it is present in our part of the world also. We have people here who indulge in promiscuous behavior. We have here people who did who do disgusting things with children, with women, and this. But we have a beacon in this sea of degeneracy, in this sea of ignorance, and in this sea of all chaos. We have beacons in the form of some religious authority. And there is a difference between, you were mentioning, Orthodox Christianity and let me make an observation on Christianity. And people can disagree with it. It is my observation, and I don't intend to offend anyone.
No. Be quite free, Muhammad. Yes. Even if people are offended, I mean, I invited you on the stream knowing that there's probably going to be a lot of pushback from the audience. But I do think that everything you say deserves to be heard. No, so be free. Be free in your expression.
Yes. Thank you. So, when it comes to Christianity, what I have read of Christianity, Christianity, and I have commented on this theme on various fora also, on Telegram and on Countercurrents also, I think. Christianity was grafted onto the trunk of Greek philosophy. Christianity had never had it, you can say, autonomous organizational structures. It relied on institutions which preceded it. Either there is too much institutionalization, I mean, that killed it killed the spontaneity of the community. The period between the 4th century and the 11th century AD, the period when the church was the strongest, it was also the period when the secular side of the things, the political administration, the crown, and the bureaucratic side, the crown, you can say, in a word, that portion or that institution of the power equation was recovering from its from the invasions or Vandals and the chaos of the decline of the Roman Empire. It took 7 or 8 centuries for it to recover. And when it recovered in the 11th or 12th centuries, coupled with the starting of urbanization in the West, when towns were propping up and when the kings and princes were not relying on the mechanism or on the instruments of the church to reach the populace. You know, church was acting as an intermediary between the crown and the local and the population, to act as channel that messaging which was coming from the estate, so it can play the role of an ultimate arbiter. The moment crown became stronger and in a position to challenge the hold of church, it outmuscled it. So, Islam, when it comes to Islam, you see, we have, let me illustrate my observation. We have 5 daily congregational prayers. The 5 times in the morning, then in the afternoon, and then in the evening. 2 prayers in the evening, 2 in the afternoon, and 1 before sunrise. This congregation and this, I would again use the word, this mobilization, this thing occurs organically, daily. So even if there is political chaos and there is a kind of totalitarianism coming from the top and there is degeneracy around you, there are still beacons. There are still poles which they guide you and you can see that beacon and find a way. This is spiritual, I would call decentralization, and is really a plus that Islam has, because we do not have as an established clergy in the form of Islam. I mean, when I say we, I don't claim any monopoly on Islam.
But there is an Islamic clergy. You have imams, we call them ojas here in the Balkans, and I'm sure that Shia Islam also has a clerical class.
Yes, we have mujtahids, but what I'm saying is that these mujtahids, these clerics, they are not in an... I am comparing them with the Catholic or the Catholic priestly class, or you know, the vicar of Christ. Pope is the vicar of Christ, and he's an intermediary. You have to reach him, and through him, Islam doesn't have this.
You're saying that the individual Muslim can interact directly with Allah.
Yes, he does. Yes.
Okay. This really sounds like, because I would like to point out that it is Orthodox Christian doctrine that there is no vicar of Christ specifically, because every faithful, every Christian can interact with God personally, even though we do need the sacraments of the church, right? So this is maybe a critique of Western-style Christianity. In Orthodoxy, this is not the case. Again, you know, I'm speaking someone who is just a believer in Orthodox Christianity. I'm not an expert in theology or all of these things, but that's interesting. I will respond that through all the difficulties that Europeans have been gone through, our faith has also been there. About a year, it was maybe 2 or 3 years ago. It was before this recent escalation of the conflict, but I saw a report about a priest in Ukraine whose church was destroyed by shelling, and basically the entire community pulled together in order to create a new altar for liturgy. He asked the local children to draw pictures of the saints because they had no icons, right, of the saints. It was one of the most touching things I ever saw. It was in a period where I was struggling with my own, you know, coming back to the faith, because I was becoming more nationalist. I was feeling, you know, the universal human yearning for faith, for God. So again, I'm sure that Islam has provided for you and your people, but again, it brings nothing new to the table for Europeans. I guess we're going to keep coming back to that.
I mean, I think it will ultimately, the decision or the encouragement towards the faith will develop and can develop naturally within the white race. I mean, I think when someone talk about a white Muslim social order, I think people imagine Saudi appointed Salafi clerics roaming on the streets of Paris or Brussels or London or Reykjavik in Iceland or Oslo in Norway. They seem to think that it is the Arabian territories that will control the Western nations if some white country embraces the faith. But that is not the case. I mean, we are not Arabs. We are Persians. We have a we have 5,000, at least 5,000 years of continuous history. So we have had Mongols, we have had Greeks, we have had the European colonizations in Indian subcontinent and in some parts of southeastern Iran. We didn't become Mongols. We didn't adapt the Tangierism of the Mongols or the Greek faith and the polytheism of the Romans or the Greeks. And we still find it quite offensive when someone amongst us starts replicating Arabic customs. You know, there was a debate in our part of the world between the phrase Allah Hafiz and Khuda Hafiz. You know, when we say goodbye, we say Khuda Hafiz. And Khuda is a Persian word for God, for Allah. And the more orthodox and those who went in Arabian territories for jobs and other stuff, and when they came back, they brought with themselves the Salafi strain of Islam. And it's a very and they brought that, and they brought the Salafi strain with them and then they started imposing they said please say Allah Hafiz instead of Khuda Hafiz, or you are not. I mean, these things that
these things are, I find they're a side effect of globalization. Yes. I think that 100 years ago, when everyone in the village was Persian and nobody really ventured much further out from the village, everyone would have just practiced the religion of their father, and you have a chain of continuity leading all the way back to the conversion of Persia. But I've noticed this here, that basically people, they think that some of the pre-Christian traditions of Macedonia, because they are under the influence of maybe American evangelicals, or they're looking for really the kind of Christianity you read from a book and not really practice in real life. They want to get rid of some of our Christmas rituals, some of our Easter rituals, which are really much older than Christianity. They come from the time of polytheism, really, but they are our traditions, and it really comes down to that. What I find interesting is, because we actually do, there is a white Muslim nation right now. It's Bosnia, right?
Yes.
And it's been Muslim for a very long time, for at least, I would say, 300 years. There's some controversy on the exact date at which a majority of Bosnians became Muslim. But let's say 300 years. And what worries me is that for 300 years, the Bosnians were primarily Bektashi, right? They were downstream of the Bektashi order, so they were kind of Sufi, right?
Yes.
But following the communist Yugoslavia and then the Bosnian independence war, in its desperation, the Bosnian government turned towards the Saudis and Al-Qaeda and all sorts of shady characters. And these people, they brought with them not just fighters, not just money, but also the Saudi-influenced clerics. And
yes.
Right now, there is no resurgence of Bektashism in Bosnia. In fact, it's actually so bad that Bektashism is on the back foot for Albanians and Muslim Macedonians. There are actually Macedonians who are of Muslim faith.
Yes, yes, yes.
And for the most part, they are Bektashi, and so were in the past some of the Albanians, not all of them. And so were Bosnians, right? This is a Sufi sect of Islam, which is very prevalent in the Balkans. It's very warlike, right? It's a warrior sect of Sufi Islam. But right now, what I'm observing among Muslims in the Balkans, among Bosnians, among Macedonian Muslims, among the Pomaks in Bulgaria, who are the Bulgarian Muslims, and among Albanians, is increasing. They're turning to Salafism, they're turning to Wahhabism, they're turning to all of these Saudi influence sects, which I'm not going to get into whether they are, you know, heretical or not, but I do find them aesthetically very unappealing. There is a good way of in the city of Ohrid in Macedonia, there is a hill on which you can stand and observe two mosques, right? The first is not only a mosque, but also a teke. So it's a burial site of a prominent Bektashi. I wouldn't call him a monk because there are no monks in Islam, but he was a sort of a dervish, right?
I see.
Right. And on the other side, there is a modern mosque, which is built really in the Saudi style. And just looking at the two mosques, you see that the old Ottoman mosque is, I recognize that it is of a faith that is not my own, but it is a thing of beauty, and it was built by men of serious faith who had respect for beauty, which is very important to me.
Yes, yes.
And that the modern mosque, which is downstream from this Saudi Salafi, whatever it is, right, is very ugly. And you can actually, there is a hill from which you can see both those things. And this is what worries me. You opened our discussion with saying that Islam is not Arabic, right?
Yes.
But you yourself tell me that Muslims in Pakistan and Persia, they are now adopting these basically Saudi or Arabic practices due to the, well, let's say for reasons, central place of not just the Arabic language, but of Arabia itself. I mean, the Prophet Muhammad was born in Mecca, right? And yes. His journey, his of proliferation, it took him to Medina, and from Medina he began his expansion. These places are physically located within Arabia, right?
Yes.
Does this not mean that there is a centrality of Arabia in the Muslim faith, which will inevitably drive all Muslims towards Arabia, you know, regardless of whether this is good for them or not? I'm certain this is not good for Bosnians or Persians.
Well, Mr. Jilbi, as far as the Salafi strain is concerned, thankfully, mercifully, it is still a very tiny portion that gets attracted to that vicious form of, I would not call it, I mean, it's naked Arab worship. It has nothing to do with this. I mean, when our ancestors adopted Islam, they embraced Islam because Islam claims that it is the continuation of a metaphysical chain that covers every single tradition that ever came up in on any place on this planet. I mean, let me share another aspect. You know, Islam mandates a lunar cycle as opposed to the solar cycle. We follow the Hijri calendar, and Hijri calendar relies on the moon. And I was listening to a podcast named Fergan. You know Fergan? He's a pagan. He made a clip a few days back, What is Paganism? And in that clip, he was describing how he practiced his meditation when he goes out near a tree. He sits there and he watches. He makes sure whether it is sunset, where is the moon. So I was reading Cornelius Tacitus, Germania. Cornelius Tacitus of he mentions something quite fascinating. I mean, I'm going to make an argument on the basis of it, but let me first share what he wrote in chapter 11 of his Germania about minor matter, and I quote, "About minor matters, the chiefs deliberate, and the more important the whole tribe. Yet even when the final decision rests with the people, the affair is always thoroughly discussed by the chiefs. They assemble except in the case of a sudden emergency on certain fixed days, either at new or at full moon. For this they consider the most auspicious season for the transaction of business. Instead of reckoning by days as we do," when he's referring to himself, Tacitus here referring to himself, "they reckon by nights, and in this manner fix both their ordinary and their legal appointments. Night they regard as bringing on day." End quote. This Islam,
it's very interesting.
Islam recognizes not the solar but lunar cycles as the primary source for temporal management of for man. The waxing moon, the full moon, and the waning moon carry deep signification. The month can be either 29 days long or 30 days. The ambiguity is deliberate. Now, another aspect is that the lunar months float throughout the seasons. And when you add the daily obligatory prayers, you find yourselves the means to frustrate the devilish universalism. You see, this mechanical fixed time is a form of totalitarianism. Fixed days, fixed nights, fixed hours, fixed festivals, 25th, fixed dates. This is a form of totalitarianism. It controls man in a very disgusting manner. I was listening to Morgoth recently. It was yesterday, in fact, with Dr. Johnson, when Mr. Morgoth said a very interesting thing. You know, man sleeps in a box, then he goes to another box, then he comes back to another box. His time is fixed. He cannot break that totalitarian temporal grid. You see? So this,
I've written about this as well. If the mods would link my essay in the chat to "Reckoning Time and Time as Reckoning," that basically what we call time is modern man thinks that time lives in the calendar and in the clock.
Yes, yes.
But time is a physical characteristic which is independent of our reckonings thereof. And it's actually a physical phenomenon. When my body ages, I am under the spell of time, right? Do continue. This is actually very interesting.
Yes. So if you have, I think you may have read The Failure of Technology by Frederick Junger. Frederick, he was the younger brother of Ernst Junger. Ernst Junger, or I'm failing at the pronunciation. Frederick wrote Junger. So Frederick wrote the book The Failure of Technology, and in that book he had a section which went by the name The Tyranny of Dead Time. How the industrial and this highly commercialized and marketized society has divided the 24 hours in three dictatorial shifts of 8 hours of work. And in this 8 hours, in all the shifts, whether it is from 9 to 5 and then whatever the mode, it subjects man to a very vicious kind of a dictatorship. And a dictatorship within to which he consciously and willingly submits itself, himself.
The interesting thing to me is, and of course, the Muslim calls to prayers. They are not bound by time, but the position of the sun, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. I've actually commented on this because we are slaves to the spreadsheet in the West and increasingly in the East. Having a 9-to-5 job, which is monotonous throughout the week and throughout the year, is very unnatural. Because when the bulk of the population was engaged in agricultural labor, we would have intermittent labor. I don't know how the situation was, although I expect that in Persia and Pakistan it would have been similar to Europe, because we do actually have a similar climate. There is less labor in the winter and there's more labor in the summer. At harvest time, you would actually have a vast shortages of labor, which would have to be made up by inviting people from other villages. At planting time and plowing time, there's a lot of labor, but for the rest of the year, villagers would actually only have light to medium labor, right? Even though they were working every day, it wasn't every day the same intensity of labor. And you can still see this in some seasonally bounded professions, like, for example, construction. If it's too cold or too hot, construction workers don't work. But for the most part, we work 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, six sometimes, you know, and with a certain monotonicity throughout the year, which is simply, I would say, not natural for the human being. And of course, there is an expectation of monotonicity of labor throughout the day, which is, again, not really natural. So I think you may have a point there. I don't really see how the lunar calendar does this. I would much prefer if we actually kept the calendar, which is based on the seasons, which corresponds to the solar calendar, because it is actually, we are also, and maybe there is a racial difference between the majority of white people and the, let's say, many Muslims, because a lot of white people, myself included, we do have something called seasonal affective disorder when our activities actually become lessened during the coldest months. And in the summer, our energy is sort of depressed because we are not really built for the heat. And our bodies are actually very more sensitive to changes in seasons, because the seasons have so much more variety in Europe. I see the lunar calendar. I see Muslims in Macedonia try to follow the lunar calendar. And so, for example, when Ramadan is in the winter, it's much easier for them.
Yes, yes.
Because it's not just because it's a shorter time that you have sunlight, but if they stick to the prohibition of everything, they don't even drink water. This is actually very difficult. And Macedonia has very hot summers. The sun is up for more than 12 hours, you could say, and just scorching heat pouring down. And I look at them and I say, yeah, this is a real sacrifice they're making with Ramadan. But it's very interesting. I don't think it's, and these are white people I'm talking about, of course. They're Muslim, but they're white. And their bodies struggle against that kind of schedule.
Yes, this is again, and I am repeating myself, but it is the marketization and commercialization of the organic section of the society, which is the last defensive line. And when you break that defensive line, you atomizes the people. You make them customers, you make them either sellers or buyers. So, I mean, they can either just, they can either be, just look at the favorite personalities which prevail around us to follow. Matlab, if you desire to idealize someone, our favorite are either a wealthy sportsman or a wealthy actor or a wealthy writer or a wealthy motivational speaker or a wealthy businessman. I mean, your leisure is directed by the market. Your occupation is directed by the market. Your education is directed by the market. Your personal relationships are directed by the market. In short, your entire being is a being that is allowed to operationalize itself only via the instruments of the market.
It is a horrible, you know, we are living in a very bad time. Mrs. Gilvey often asks me, why did we have to be born at such a time? But I usually quote Tolkien at her. Thus, this is a question which bedevils all who are born to live in such times. It's our cross to bear, so to speak. We have donations. We have 14 lemons from Slog, and Slog always delivers with the 14 lemons. Thank you for that, kind sir. Kitos Setruesta, I believe your people say. Although I could use a little assistance from my good friend and former host of the Writer's Block, Full Moon Ancestry. He speaks Finnish, not me. And we have donations on Entropy, which we need to read out. I have $5 from Hapa Perspective. And he says, Nix, thanks for helping me out with my test stream. I clearly have a lot of iron out. Turns out I can't host your stream until I'm partnered with DLive. And also hello to Muhammad Aryan. Well, thank you, Hapa Perspective, for your donation.
Hello, Mr. Hapa Perspective.
Right. And for everyone who does not know, Hapa Perspective has begun streaming on DLive. He is streaming about 2 hours before the writer's block. So not 10 p.m. Central European time. He starts at 8. And he is doing gaming streams. He played, I forget the name of the game, but it was about Russian and American soldiers fighting in some Eastern European country. So it might not be a game for long, but as long as it is a game, make sure to watch Hapa Perspective blow away communists. And maybe next week he's going to play Cuck Simulator. It's a symbol of the degeneracy of our age that someone made that into a video game. I watched a couple of playthroughs of that on YouTube, and it's hilarious. it's just a hilarious video game. But it's also tragic. I've never been so shocked, horrified, disgusted, and entertained at the same time. And we have $10 from Gadius Maximus, and he has a question for Muhammad. He asks one simple question for the guests. Do non-white Muslims belong in Europe?
No. They do not belong in Europe. They do not belong in Europe. And my distant relatives, some of them, they reside in America, that is, in Canada, in Europe, and in Australia also. And at least for me, whenever someone asks me, I quote a verse from Quran where Allah Almighty tells or informs the man of the reality of the differences between people, between different tribes, between languages. And just as it is a manifestation of reality that there is a difference between races, and it is so it is a falsehood if someone denies the existence of races and tries to forcefully integrate or mix them. Multiculturalism is a fraud. I don't buy that. And I mean, people here take these things which comes through the that nonsensical channel known as the New York Times or BBC or CNN. I mean, there are people here who behave like like brown Bill Maher's, like the brown version of Bill Maher and others. I mean, this is crap. This is, I don't buy this forced integration. Race is a concrete reality. It is a reality. And no, non-whites do not belong in. Non-whites belong to their own territories. They do not belong there. I don't buy it.
That is an excellent position. Actually, that is my position. Every race has its own space. It has its own continent, and that is where it belongs. So I guess that answers Gaudius's questions. And this actually is a good segue into a question I wanted to ask you myself. One of the biggest objections that white identitarian nationalists have towards the Christian faith now is that it's universalist, and that its adoption by white people has led to our current predicament. And it is in fact the Christian faith which has spiraled into the problem we have today with progressivism and multiculturalism, multiracialism, and at the core of it all lies the egalitarian, really, assumption, the assumption that all men are created equal. Now, this was, of course, rhetorical hyperbole by Thomas Jefferson when he wrote it, but it is taken as an item of faith by our enemy, the progressive left here in the West, and their confederates, the controlled opposition, the conservative right. Now, the problem is, of course, if the universalist religion of Christianity led to this manifestation, basically manifests itself like this in our civilization's decadent phase, why wouldn't Islam, which is also a universalist religion, a religion for all people at all time, these are your words, I believe, and in the Quran, this is for the entire world, not just for Arabs, yes, not just for Persians, right?
Yes.
Wouldn't Islam also, in its inevitable civilizational decadent phase, manifest this universalism? Isn't it already manifesting these same problems of universalism in different form, but very similar ones?
You see, people migrate towards white societies because white societies have been reduced to departmental stores and office blocks. I mean, the Occident at the moment is a big office block with a huge parking lot, and people are just living in that office block. So they are responding to their material and their hedonistic desires because they see Occident as a provider, as a quencher of their thirst. The moment Occident ceases to be that attraction, they will naturally retreat. I mean, take the issue of the grooming gangs in Britain, those perverse animals. I mean, it would be a great day if some white guys douse those, and pardon my language.
Please, we know what they deserve, but let's not say it out loud.
I mean, let me rephrase it. Sort them out. Gently sort them out. It would be a
using argumentation and understanding.
Yes, it is argumentation and understanding without words. It would be a great day, and we don't need that filth back. So the moment you start, the white man start honoring and start protecting his woman folk, his children. I mean, the rate of illegitimacy and births out of wedlock is depressing. The chaos of white society, the complete and utter demolition, systematic distortion of white societies make them a place of attraction for those of us who give in to their material needs. I mean, and as far as the race and that side is concerned, I mean, and whether Islam will destroy the way Christianity did, or I mean, it has different reasons. I can elaborate on that as well. But as far as Islam, I mean, we are Persians even after embracing Islam. We are Indo-Iranians, Indo-Aryans. Still, we have our language, we have our customs and traditions. And Islam, not only gave strength to our nationality, to our ethno-cultural bonding, it elevated us. I mean, as I said previously, we didn't adopt the religion of Mongols. We didn't adopt the religions of the Greeks and Macedonians when they came here. When the Arabs came, they didn't come to impose Islam on us. I mean, if we had a chance after two or three centuries in the 8th and 9th century, when we have autonomous Persian kingdoms in Iran, when we threw the yoke of Arab dictatorships in 7th and 8th centuries, and when we had native Persian monarchies in the present state of Iran and some territories of Pakistan were also included. I mean, we had a chance. If our ancestors had embraced the faith on pain of death, they could have thrown that faith away and gone back to Zoroastrianism. But no, they saw something natural. They saw something vital. They saw something they saw something honorable in this faith. And they had the wisdom to sift Arabic chauvinism and that barbarity from Islam. I mean, these people didn't spare the family of the Prophet. I mean, I am a Shia by school of thought. My school of thought is Shia. We have a special regard for the Prophet's family, and our spiritual. We consider that the Prophet's spiritual successor is Imam Ali, peace be upon him. So they didn't spare the family. So their viciousness preceded Islam. And these are still very...
My objection is, of course, the very conception of the Ummah, which is a sort of brotherhood for all Muslims on the planet. I believe it is a teaching of Islam that you are the brother of the Muslim, you know, over in Arabia, and the Muslim also. And of course, there is the Sunni Shia difference, which you can elucidate for us for a Western audience. But it is precisely this problem which we have in the Christian religion, right? This notion that some African from Nigeria who converts to Christianity this somehow gives him the right to live in my space, in the place of Europeans where we live, and to, well, interbreed with our women, because marriage is a religious institution. It's never not going to be a religious institution, and family is itself a religious institution. We spoke about this with Catherine S. when we discussed both the ancient city, which concerned really the paganism of the Indo-Europeans, which your ancestors and mine shared this primordial religion,
yes,
of course. And further, when we discussed Mircea Eliade's Sacred and the Profane, there is no way in which marriage and the family are not a religious category. Mm-hmm. The problem is, if the religion preaches brotherhood between all the faithful, regardless of ethnicity and race, which is very important to us as white identitarian nationalists, then this creates a problem for us. This creates a problem for us as a political group. We see this problem in Christianity. It is present. I mean, I'm not going to abandon Christianity because of this problem, but I recognize that the religion actually has this problem within itself. We also retained our nationalities here in Europe, but we are told by religious nationalists that they are unimportant. We are told that racial differences are unimportant. And I see the beginning of such problem. And in practice, I see that problem in Islam. Like, I will come back to the way in which these Arabic ways of being and thinking and interpreting the faith leaked into the Islam of Bosnia and of Albanians and of Macedonian Muslims, precisely because belonging to a common faith weakened the boundaries between these nations, right? And does Islam have a special answer to this problem, which maybe Christianity does not contain? Or will we be changing our faith just to be faced with the same problem in the end, I guess?
I think the uniformity of the Arabic language, which is prevalent in the Islamic domain. I mean, we do not pray in our vernacular tongues. We all pray in Arabic, whether he is a Bengali Muslim, whether he is a Indonesian Muslim, or whether he is a Pakistani Muslim or an Iranian or a Nigerian or a Bosnian or a white convert, he will pray in Arabic. So I think people often confuses this linguistic uniformity as a gateway, as a trigger to an eventual adoption of Arabian culture. In Bosnian, and you can see not only in Bosnia, but you can see the Salafi penetration in Chechnya also. Although Russia has been very sensitive for that region, and I am not an expert on that region, but I think once Putin, during his early years, quite forcefully said that, oh, you people should follow the Sufi strain and do not, you should not look at that that Saudi version of Islam. But
I think he favored the Shia version of whatever. I'm not sure. I think the Chechens may be Shia.
No, Chechens are Sunnis. They are not Shias.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Chechens are. So that linguistic side of the things, that linguistic uniformity, I think often confuses some people. They think that now it gives people a green signal to start culturally intermingling with each other. I mean, I would say again, I'm still a Persian. My culture was not destroyed by Islam because Islam was communicating me on a different plane, on a different dimension. My ethnicity, my preferences for marriage, my preferences for friendship, all, of course, I'm gentle. Islam teaches to be like every other faith. Teaches to be gentle and respectful for elders and kind to youngsters. But it does not force me to not love my own. I love my own, but I not consider my bloodline or my family or my ancestral line or my ethnicity as a benchmark for right and wrong. I love my brothers and sisters. I love my community. I would like to die among my people. I would like, Because you see, I am speaking you from my own soil. I mean, I am not sitting in the West. I am sitting on my own soil. And an overwhelming majority of us prefer to live amongst their own. It is only in the last, I would say, 60 or 70 years with this free movement of people. And let me share an a funny thing which our people bring up to counter this line of thinking which I am right now taking. They say, oh, Allah created the universe. Why are you limiting a movement? You know, America also created by Allah. Canada also created by Allah. England was also created by Allah. I say, okay, Afghanistan was also created by Allah. Iraq was also created by Allah. Iran was also created by Allah. Why are you not migrating there? Why are you not taking a family to Iraq or Uzbekistan or Central Asia or Mongolia? Why these Anglophone white countries? Because you want to quench your material thirsts. Because you are forced to, these have pure material.
See, this is what I'm trying to ask you, Muhammad, is we see the same argumentation, the same liberal open borders argumentation, which, you know, Muslim liberals express in Islamic terms. You see it from Christian liberals expressing it in Christian terms, you know, like, oh, well, Jesus said, love your neighbor. And this is why we got to take all of these refugees in. What I'm trying to say is that both faiths have this weak spot, which makes them vulnerable to, let's call it, subversion by people who want to erase the borders between nations and races, right? And this has been with us since the very beginning here in Christianity. The Christianity's problems of egalitarianism and universalism, right, have been with us since the beginning, since the teachings of Jesus, right? Islam's same problems, from my limited understanding of the faith, have been with it. Islam is a universalist faith. It's also egalitarian, right? Although it respects human hierarchies as Christianity does, in its, you know, liberalized form, in its poisoned, subverted form, it tries to erase them, right? This is my point here. There is nothing really unique about Islam, the way you're presenting it to me, which would protect against this subversion. And if the West is going to change its faith, right, it's going to have to, ideally people would change faith because they really believe it, but we all know this mostly happens due to political concerns and because civilizations change or to survive, they change or die. They're put in such situations. Rome did not become Christian because they suddenly liked it. Rome converted to Christianity because it was either convert to Christianity or complete degeneration, right? It was a very old civilization. It had completely lost its old faith. So it found this new faith and it clung onto it. And it survived in the forms of the Germanic kingships, which succeeded it, and the Eastern Roman Empire. So what I'm trying to say here, Muhammad, is, again, the same problems of Christianity I see in Islam, and I see that liberals in Pakistan and in many other Muslim countries, right, and in countries with Muslims, will express their liberalism in Muslim terms. This is what worries me.
I think here the social and the communitarian aspect of Islam comes quite powerfully. You see, Islam's emphasis on social in a given community, let's say my community, it governs my social interactions so minutely, and it engages me with my community so continuously and with a kind of a thorough discipline that it automatically creates a cordon that is very difficult for another culture to breach. And that is why you see little small communities, like you see Pashtuns, you see Baloch, you see Punjabis, Sindhis, Iranians, Azeris, Turks, and these small communities, when they interact with each other, their ceremonies, daily prayers, and then fasting, then Eid, Eid al-Azha, Eid al-Fitr, these festivals, they naturally prop up a communitarian strain within the people. And it's so continuous. I mean, I'm saying it again and again. It's the social side of Islam that is quite healthy and quite fascinating, because it keeps you continuously in contact with your people. You know, Islam does not have a monasticism or an ascetic culture that you retreat from your society and goes to a closed space, and you are in a state of celibacy. You are not marrying. You are not having children. Islam doesn't accept that. It forcefully.
But the social problems of the West are not due to monasticism. We have an excess of people giving into their urges. Right? Yes. You could use some monasticism right now.
Yes, I was coming to the Christian side. I was just making an argument from the Muslim side, and I was coming to the Christian side. You see, Christianity, for some reasons, surrendered its value system. After the urbanization of the Occident, it had to reconcile with the emerging powers, which was the nation state and the centralized bureaucracies. It surrendered. Islam never surrendered its social aspects. You know. And its value system. One example, and how it is a very lively tradition. Someone can disagree, and before going into that argument, let me say that I am not a free speech absolutist. I don't want my comment to be published somewhere because that forum believes in freedom of speech. I want my comment to be published because they think that it is a grown-up argument and it should be there. And if it is not a grown-up argument, then it shouldn't be there. Freedom should not be a criteria for someone. I mean, people should have a value that judges us. So I was saying that you must have remembered the Rushdie affair, when Salman Rushdie published the Satanic Verses, and Imam Khomeini, may Allah rest his soul, published a fatwa against him, and he was and they all. The British state machinery was mobilized to protect this man from would-be assassins, because he wrote some really stupid and nasty things about the Prophet. And no, we don't accept that. And this is a red line. Any Muslim society, whether it is Indonesian, Pakistani, or Indian, or it will not accept that. So this was one indication that it has a very lively value system. It would come down very hard on those who would challenge its red lines. And now compare it with those Jewish comedians who repeatedly mock Jesus Christ, peace be upon him, in the West. I mean, the kind of crap Sarah Silverman produces, or Larry David has over the year produced in the name of comedy. I mean, it's just disgraceful and disgusting. So, you know, the values of the market prevails in the West. Christianity as an institution reconciled with it during the Enlightenment. It accepted the liberal framework. It accepted the liberal order. Islam never did that. Islam never ceded an inch on its holy red lines. And this is its strength. and this will be manifest, and naturally, because I will come down again to that point, because it deals with the primordial nature of man. It's a natural thing. It deals with the fitra, the fitrat. It engenders a sense of sacredness, a sense of holiness, that there are some lines which people cannot cross, and that is my argument.
That's very interesting. I will say that I'm always impressed by the seriousness with which Muslims take their faith. Whereas in the West, Christians tolerate a lot of mockery of Christianity. Yes. And it's gotten to the point where in the United Kingdom, it's when you mock Jesus, right, it's likelier Muslims who will object than Christians, which is a very sad testament to Christianity in the United Kingdom. But it is what it is. I'm still unconvinced that there is something in the structure of the Muslim faith which will lead to this. See, I've been reading Dr. Kevin MacDonald, and of course you are a scholar of Dr. Kevin MacDonald as well. It's these traits, specifically this tendency towards individualism and liberalism, from which they're basically the same thing. Liberalism is politicized individualism. But from his recent work, specifically in individualism and the Western liberal tradition, we can discover that this tendency is maybe genetically inherent to white people, and specifically to Northwestern European white people, although all white people have it to a certain degree. It is the most pronounced in Northwestern Europeans, so people from the lands bordering the North Sea in Europe. So the question here is, even if we did convert to Islam, I guess, our biology, the way we were created, the way we are, would have still led us to develop this kind of way of interpreting the world, right? Because from what I know about Bektashism, it's a Sufi school. It's very heterodox in Islam, specifically because it is an Islam developed, it's an Islamic sect developed by white people of the Balkan Peninsula, right? Who's to say that if history had gone differently, and white people had converted to Islam instead of Christianity, right? And maybe people in the Middle East, Iraqis and Assyrians, they had remained the bulk of the majority of Christians as they were during the time of the Nestorian Church and the Nestorian Patriarch. Maybe the story would have been different. We would have been now speaking about a history where Islam is the liberal faith, and liberalism came from an Islamic context, whereas Christianity is presenting itself as the conservative faith. It's, and people in the chat are pointing out, we used to be in the West serious about our faith too for a very long time. Blasphemy was never tolerated. It was a crime as recently as the mid-20th century in some jurisdictions. Severely punished. Heresy was not tolerated. We put our heretics to death. It's what you do with heretics. So maybe it is not a question of whether the faith is like this or like that, but these are Spenglerian questions. Maybe this is just Western civilization. It's in its winter, and whatever it does, no, it could be maybe revitalized by a shock to the system, but whatever happens, we are going to lose faith. We are going to become materialist and secular and individualist, and it may be even inherent to our own genetics, if we take Kevin MacDonald's arguments. So how would you respond to that?
I think psychological observations are always a bit slippery. They are still consist of counterfactuals, some speculation. I mean, Mr. McDonald has, on some occasions, had clearly pointed out that he is making an argument from some given facts. I mean, he is speculating. Much of this is speculation. So on the basis of speculation, it is always a bit shaky to come to a conclusion. And as far as that scenario in which whether the Middle East, a huge majority of Middle East had remained Christian, I mean, here is a very interesting thing. The muscularity you see in Eastern Christian faiths, like the Orthodox of Syria, of the Maronites of Lebanon, the Copts of Egypt, or the Chalcedonian Church of Iraq, which incidentally fought alongside Shia brigades against ISIS and crushed it in Mosul, or other denominations, the Armenians, neighboring Turkey, the Armenian church, it's a very muscular form of Christianity. Still, have you ever wondered why is the case? Why is such the case? Because it is surrounded by a faith which is lively and has some very strict red lines. It is because of Islam that these particular churches are still quite muscular.
Well, in my experience is, look, I'm an Orthodox Christian, right?
Yes.
And how do I put this? When Westerners come to me and they ask me, oh, why are you Orthodox so based? Is it something about the faith, right? And I say to them, no, it's not something about the faith. The fact of the matter is we seem comparatively, you know, right-wing to you, comparatively conservative to you, because our cultural lags maybe 10, 20 years behind the West. So if you in the West are at this stage where you have a massive immigration and, drag queen story hours and transsexual children, we're still at the, well, just let them get married stage for homosexuals. We're still at the stage where you can see very few, you know, foreigners living here, non-whites. Just, oh yeah, he's the local black person. We have fun when we teach him Macedonian curse words. We're still at that stage. It has really nothing to do with Orthodox doctrine or theology that our churches are like this or like that. Our churches are like this or like that because our people are like this. That's the main difference. You look at, for example, the American Orthodox Church. It's not much better than any American Protestant church, I would say. And very soon, you see these signs of degenerations. There are more and more, I would say, bishops of the Macedonian Orthodox Church who are giving in to the West's degeneracy and rot. This is also happening in the Islamic community here. I think that these churches are muscular because those people are muscular. I've met some Armenians in my life, Syrian Christians. I've met some Copts. These are a strong, hardy people. I think that the people really make the religion, and that doctrine is, the doctrine is important to scholars and to priests, you know. But to the people, what's important is tradition. What's important is to worship the same way your father worshiped, to honor your ancestors, to make children. So that, and it's very important for them to for religions to institute the institutions of daily life, such as marriage, family, business, labor. Business is also always a religious undertaking. I mean, how can you make an entity such as a legal person without the intervention of the divine? This is something we forget when we talk about labor and work and the economy and even capitalism. The ancient Romans would, when they started new businesses, they would consecrate it, where they would have a feast And of course, here in the East, you have people, they start a new business and they have a priest sanctify the premises and bless the profits. It's actually very, very interesting ceremony. But all of these, this is what people want from religion, and their religion will reflect it then. Of course, I'm not going to deny that religion has an effect on people, but the far greater effect is the biology of man working down outward into the faith and changing it to fit its needs. And this is why I can talk about, for example, I can safely call Bektashism a white people Islam. This is why I can call, I can talk about orthodoxy as the religion, not, it's not very readily universalizable, because pretty soon you run into the specific character of maybe, you know, Western Mediterraneans or Northwestern Europeans, and you realize that all of these sectarian schisms we have in Christianity are most of the time due to biological differences between us, which translate into psychological differences. So this is my position, Muhammad, that I don't think that Islam can make so much of a difference, right? A lot of people are worried about, oh, what will happen if white people convert to Islam. I don't think we will substantially change, which, you know, is a good thing, but also it's a bad thing, because white people are in a crisis. We need to substantially change, or we will die out.
The emphasis of Islam on human nature, and nature, I mean, I'm translating an Arabic term, fitrat, which we use, which is the Quranic term for nature. Nature is not an approximate translation. I mean, translations, I must say, is a very risky business. You are trying to contain, I mean, if a word has a depth like an ocean, and when you translate it into another language, you find a word which has a similar depth. And when you don't find a similar word, you make it. I mean, to compare fitrat with nature is, I'm trying to contain an ocean in a bucket.
I know you're a Heidegger, you're interested in Heidegger, but would you say that fitra better design in no. translation?
No.
No? Okay.
No. So this problem has been with other traditions, like take Hinduism, for instance. Hinduism is currently in India facing a similar problem which the whites are facing in the West. I mean, the muscular Hindutva of Narendra Modi, which you see in the media, is just, it's a political ploy. They are controlling the Hindu society from top down, and they are tapping into the Hindu middle class using the religion. And it is a very dangerous ploy, because like Christianity, Hinduism too is very weak on the social side of the things. It's regimentalism, what I would call it's regimentalization of society. It's very weak. So your query regarding whether it would benefit the white race or not, I still believe it would benefit the white race, because Islam deals with the primordial state of man. It recognizes differences. It connects man not only with his self, but with the outer cordon, which is his community. It benefited. I mean, every single race, and again, it would not be a loss of Islam, because as I said in my introductory remarks, if we today start behaving in a lewd way or start living a life which is away from this fitra, so we too will destroy ourselves. I would recommend to my fellow whites, to my friends living, white nationalists. I'm not a white, so I was...
Okay, I'm sorry. You know the meme associated with fellow whites, though, right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
To my friends in the Occident, let me rephrase it. To my friends in the Occident, I would recommend that they should learn the Arabic language, because that is the key. It would seem that as if you are adopting Arabian culture or Arabian customs, or you are giving in, or you are conceding ground to a foreign or a invading or an immigrant culture. But I would say that it would unlock the mysteries of reality for you, because, as I said, Arabic vocabulary is like a password. It is a passkey to reality. And that I can say after comparing the language with English, with Persian, with some regional languages here, and with a little bit Latin or French. So it has its potential, because it is a living language. It is recited. It is intonated. I mean, pagans in Europe place a special emphasis on chants and hymns. They recite the chorus. They recite when they are in the woods. So this the power of the spoken word, on which Islam has relied, as opposed to the written word, and the scriptural side, the Christianity relied on a scripture. It is a written word, but Islam relies on the spoken word. So this is a very different and unique aspect of Islam. It linguistically not only opens new avenues, but reinforces your own linguistic foundations. For instance, take the word reality, which we have been using quite often in this talk. When I say the word reality, I immediately relate it to the Arabic term haqq, which I recite daily in my daily prayers, in the congregational prayers, or when I was reciting some zikr. You know, zikr meditation Muslims do on beads. We call it a tasbih on stones. So this what I call a kind of a metaphysical vocabulary that works on another plane. It nourishes your native tongue also. So that is why the deconstruction and this dismantling of language, it never worked in our part of the world, and it will never work, because our ontological foundations are extremely firm. I mean, I disagree with the word philosophy. Islam doesn't have a philosophy. Islam doesn't have a philosophy. People use it to detail their doctrines, but Islam doesn't deal with philosophy. Is you don't reach to ultimate reality through philosophy lectures or through philosophizing. So that is my view.
This actually might, a lot of people might object to this in the West, because we, I guess it's, maybe it's downstream of our genetics, but a lot of people in the West love philosophy for its own sake and take great pleasure in it. And in many ways, the story of the West is the story of putting a primacy on philosophy. And of course, there is the whole question of, we do not appreciate the spoken word as much as maybe we should, which is what I'm trying to bring back in a certain way with these live streams. Although it is the writer's block, and we do use writing as a let's call it an ancillary resource on the writer's block, it is primarily a spoken word type medium. There was a very interesting article by Richard Hanania. I think he's Lebanese. He could be Jewish, but I think he's Lebanese. Where he said something like, conservatives watch TV, liberals read. And it could be conceivable that the great divide between Christianity and Islam is as simple as that. Christians read, Muslims not watch TV, but listen. And
recite.
He used watch TV in the sense of used primarily non-written communication, spoken, shown, because you watch TV and you listen to the TV, but you don't read the TV. And apparently, and this is actually, Greg Johnson has said this, it's apparently the brain does not use the same centers when processing spoken and written language, because this is I couldn't believe this is possible until I witnessed it myself. Greg can read German, but he cannot speak it, and he has great difficulty understanding spoken German. And I've actually, in my own case, it's like I have the same problem with Russian. I can read Russian, but I cannot speak it, and I cannot understand spoken Russian. If they speak very, very slowly, maybe I can understand it. But that's an interesting distinction.
A point I would like to make here. Interrupting Mr. Jelvi, sorry.
No problem.
This aspect, which I have also, which I also highlighted in one of my comments in Countercurrents. I mean, I don't remember when I did that, but this linguistic aspect of man is very unique. I mean, we can switch to languages, to different families, a child born to German parents, if he grows up in a Spanish household, he would not speak German, he would speak Spanish. I mean, it's a fascinating thing. Somehow there is something beyond biology when it comes to language. It's quite demonstrated. I mean, one can demonstrate it. I mean, I'm speaking, I can understand English, I can write in English, although I don't converse in English because we converse here in Urdu or other regional languages. So my conversational English is not that. I can't speak in flow because I don't speak the language daily. But the fact that we can comprehend several languages and we can master several languages of, I mean, a Bengali and an Indonesian whose language family is Afro-Asiatic, and he recites his prayers in Arabic, in clear Arabic. You cannot differentiate whether he's a native Arab or a non-Arab guy. So this linguistic aspect is a very mysterious dimension of man, which should be explored.
It is certainly a fascinating aspect of the human animal. One which basically my own journey towards becoming a nationalist and a dissident began because I found the difference between written and spoken language to be too great to reconcile. And I've been trying to reconcile the two, specifically, you know, the way in which Macedonian language is written, because writing really is a representation of the spoken language. And we should treat it like that. Modernity treats us basically, this is very postmodern, everything lives within the text. And the first victim of a text-centered analysis of language is spoken language. It is, when we focus on the spoken word, we sort of revolt against the modern world. We have donations through Entropy, which I would like to read out. Friedrich says, for 10 American dollars, he says, great stream. Thank you. Well, thank you, Friedrich. And I had a great time yesterday when we were together on the Countercurrents birthday stream. Amazing person, Friedrich. He's been on in chat all day. Well, we have 4 minutes to conclude. So Muhammad, if you have any closing remarks, now is the time to give them.
I just again would like to thank Countercurrents to you for providing me an opportunity to express myself. This is my maiden appearance on this is my maiden appearance. I never appeared anywhere. I was just commented, and I just comment. I don't do these podcast things. I mean, I am not quite into these things, but thanks for this opportunity. It's great that despite all the confusion and viciousness that mass media throws in front of us daily 24/7, how it shamelessly vitiates the environment to demonize a group of people, whites, in the present context. We can see how it is now, I mean, shamelessly demonizing a group of people, as if all other men and all other groups of men have no skeletons in their cupboards. So it's nice that we can have a civilized, measured, grown-up conversation in this time. And your movement has some truth, that you can attract someone from this, from that far, from Pakistan, and who agrees with the morality of your struggle. Of course, have my disagreements, but they are respectable disagreements. And my faith mandates me, it commands me to be just in dealing with people, to uphold the values that I believe in. And so it's very nice to have a conversation, whether I am writing comments on Telegram or Countercurrents, or I'm speaking here. It's the respectable nature of conversation that is lacking in the cyber domain. People think that because we have a curtain of anonymity between two men, so that gives us a green signal to behave like an to behave like a child. I mean, when I refer to someone, it happened once when I was conversing with someone, and I was repeatedly calling that man sir, and sir, I don't disagree with you. He told me, "Oh, why are you calling me sir?" He was of the view that, you know, after two or three sentences, it descends into a brawl on the comment section. And why are you being so civil? Why are you being so civil? Why are you not abusing me? So the gist of it, I mean, we can have our disagreements. I have my disagreements. You can have our disagreement. The fact is that we can have a grown-up conversation in this environment, and that is a wonderful thing. And these are my final words.
It's certainly what I'm trying to cultivate, both here on the writer's block and on the various places where I am in Telegram chats, in DLive and Odyssey chats. People should try to be civil to each other. I understand times are tough and a lot of people are angry, and the temptation is always there to really let rip on the internet and shout at people on the internet, abuse them. But never forget that wrath is a sin. It eats away at the soul, it injures man, and it alienates him from what he ought to be genuinely doing. And with that message, I think we can conclude the writer's block. I'm your friend and host, Nick Gilvey, and our guest tonight was Muhammad Aryan. And you can visit his website, which is muhammadizadi.com. And our heroic moderators have put it in the chat. I want to thank them. I want to thank Reed Johnson, Yadius Maximus, and Bartleby, who have kept the DLive and Odyssey chats safe and respectable and very polite. And we got some rambunctious people in the chat, but that's always, that's comes with the territory, I guess. I want to thank everyone who tuned in. I want to thank everyone who listens in to the replay. I want to thank everyone who donated tonight. Your contributions make Countercurrents possible. And, well, I guess that's it. Bye-bye, people. Goodbye.
Yeah. Goodbye. Goodbye.